Biden came out of the campaign standing taller than when he entered. "People agree," said his advisor John Mertilla, "that your stature has been enhanced." The question was whether to cash in that currency by supporting either Clinton or Obama. Joe was close to Hillary, extremely close, treating her with the warmth and protectiveness of an older brother. He kept a picture in his Senate office of Hillary laughing as Biden whispered in one ear and her husband in the other. But while he'd started out, like all the veterans in the field, thinking Obama was too big for his britches, not ready to be president, Biden had revised his opinion. "He's the real deal," he told the table. Biden was inclined not to endorse anyone. His inner circle agreed, arguing that it made no sense to foreclose any possibilities, of which they saw two. Secretary of State was the obvious one. They all assumed he'd be in the running, especially if Hillary won. But Biden might even have a chance at being on the ticket. With the Democrats headed toward choosing the first female or the first black nominee in history, a white male with gravitas could be tempting for either Clinton or Obama. Although Biden made a show of scoffing at the running mate talk, he was willing to proceed with the strategy his staff devised for a kind of soft campaign. There would be no lobbying, no phone calls, no talking up his name. Biden would go back to the Senate, try to build on the best aspects of his performance in 2007. He would hammer the GOP on foreign policy, offer advice to Clinton or Obama if they sought him out, and keep his yap shut about everything else. Biden informed Barack and Hillary that he wouldn't be endorsing them, but also pledged to each that he wouldn't endorse the other. "My word is a Biden," was one of his pet phrases. The family name meant a lot to Joe, and he was giving them his word now. For the next 5 months, Biden talked incessantly to Clinton and Obama. They just kept calling him. At first, it was mostly about policy, but later, as the race dragged on and Hillary's chances faded, Biden began to play honest broker, trying to engineer a peaceful end to the brawl. He counseled Clinton that she should ignore the pressure to drop out, make up her own mind, but delicately added that it made sense for her to stay in only if she believed she had a realistic shot of winning, say 1 in 3. To Obama, Biden said, "Don't push her over the cliff. You've got to respect her. Let her take her time. A graceful exit is in everyone's interest." After Obama's race speech in March, Biden had become an avid fan, telling aides it was the best oration he had heard since Dr. King. But his respect for Clinton was undiminished. In fact, he told Obama point blank that he should pick her as his running mate. Biden's advisors were beside themselves when they heard that. "What the hell was Joe doing?" they asked each other, "boosting Hillary for his job?" But Biden didn't care. He thought Hillary had earned it and doubted he'd be in the veep stakes running anyway. Anyone who knew the history between Obama and Biden would have shared that skepticism. In their first 2 years together in the Senate, Biden's behavior toward Obama was similar to McCain's, condescending and patronizing to the point where it rankled. "Can you believe this guy?" Obama said to his Senate staff. "Can you believe what Biden did today?" In the course of 2007 and 2008, however, Obama had changed his mind about Biden just as Biden had flipped on Obama. He liked the way Joe had handled himself on the trail, appreciated his working-class appeal. The unions loved Joe, and so did the cops after his championing of the crime bill in the 90s. That clean, mainstream, articulate thing? In public, Obama took a little potshot at Biden when it happened, to appease the African-American groups, but in private, the comment rolled right off his back. When Biden called him to atone, Obama told him, "Joe, you don't have to explain anything to me." Not long after he clinched the nomination, Obama started hinting to his brain trust that he was leaning in Biden's direction. He mentioned it to Axelrod and Jared and gave the same impression to Rahm Emanuel, whom Obama had asked to throw some ideas in the hopper about potential veeps. One night, on the phone, he complained to Emanuel, "You haven't given me a single name." Emanuel flatly said that he wasn't going to. "Why?" asked Obama. "It's just like 1992, Emanuel replied, when he'd been involved with Bill Clinton's VP selection process. They examined some 40 names that year, but all along Clinton kept bringing up Gore, singing the praises of his book Earth in the Balance. This is over, Emanuel told Obama. You've decided on Biden. We're just going through the process to make sure your gut's right. Process mattered to Obama. Head overruled gut, as always. The screening system he implemented was rigorous and methodical. On June 4th, not even 24 hours after the nomination fight ended, Obama announced that his selection committee would be run by Carolyn Kennedy and former Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder. 2 weeks later, the Obama campaign said that Patty Sullis Doyle was joining Team Obama as the eventual VP nominee's chief of staff. The move enraged Hillary supporters, since it seemed to signal that Clinton was off the table for the number two spot. By July, Obama's pollsters were focus group testing potential running mates with voters in Cleveland and Milwaukee. The first list the committee handed Obama had a dozen names. Many of those that appealed to him were problematic. He liked Tom Daschle, but Daschle had become a Washington influence peddler. Sebelius, the Kansas governor, had no national experience or foreign policy chops, and as Sullis Doyle argued, her selection might offend Clinton supporters on the grounds that if Obama was going to choose a woman, it should be Hillary. Virginia Senator Jim Webb refused to be vetted. Obama's pollsters reported that voters strongly preferred that the nominee choose a gray-headed Washington insider and that Chris Dodd tested well. But Dodd's connection as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee to the subprime mortgage debacle made him a non-starter. Obama was less than thrilled with the slimness of the pickings, and despite his reverence for process, kept raising a name that wasn't on any ledger, Clinton. "Let's just run through the Hillary option again," he would say to his brain trust. "She's tough, she's smart, she's prepared to be president, she has a constituency, she's got 18 million votes, you can't just dismiss all that." The brain trust shook its collective head, reminding Obama of all the hassles that Clinton would bring, not least of them, Bill. They told Barack their research showed that swing voters had a hard time accepting him and Hillary suddenly holding hands and crooning kumbaya. Jarrett and Plouffe were dead set against putting Clinton on the ticket, and so was Michelle, who had yet to forgive or forget Hillary's comment about RFK. By the end of July, the Clinton option was finally buried and the list was whittled down to three: Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, Indiana Senator Evan Bayh, and Biden. Of the group, Kaine was the person with whom Obama felt the closest personal bond. Both were Harvard law grads, both had spent time overseas as children, and bizarrely, both their mothers and maternal grandparents hailed from the same tiny town of El Dorado, Kansas. Obama knew Bayh less well, but his political appeal was manifest. He was the young, handsome, former two-term governor of the Hoosier state, one of the red states that the Obamans hoped to capture, and the centrist scion of the state's most famous political family. Kaine and Bayh submitted eagerly to the investigative cavity search that being shortlisted entailed. After the first round of interviews, Kaine's wife said to him over dinner, "Tim, if there's anything you haven't told me, I think you should, because it's probably going to come out." They both cracked up. Their teenage son was less mirthful when the vetters grilled him about his Facebook profile. Bayh, self-conscious about a recent weight loss, explained in detail to the vetters about his apparent digestive trouble with dairy and gluten, then arranged for a $5,000 consultation with a specialist recommended to him by Hillary. The phones rang for all three finalists in the first week of August, summoning them for interviews with Obama. Bayh was smuggled into St. Louis, Kaine into small-town Indiana. The Biden interview in Minneapolis came last. For 90 minutes, they sat in the suite at Grave 601, feeling each other out. Obama ribbed Biden about the financial details his vetters had turned up. "All these years and you still have no money," Obama teased. The salient question for Obama was, did Biden really want the gig? He'd seemed hesitant throughout the vetting process. Did Biden think the job was too small? Did Biden think Biden was too big? Would he rather be Secretary of State? Biden replied that it all depended on how Obama envisioned the job of VP. The role he could embrace was that of counselor-in-chief, weighing in on every important decision, foreign and domestic, contributing his expertise on congressional relations, legislative strategy, judicial appointments, all of it. The key, Biden said, was building a relationship based on candor, at which point Obama laughed. "I know you'll be candid," Obama said. "Are you prepared for me to be?" "Absolutely," Biden answered. The next day, Russia invaded Georgia, markedly enhancing Biden's prospects as the shortlister with the most bombs and bullets cred. He talked the idea over with Jill and his family, who said they were all for it. After months of living with the concept, Biden had come around. He wanted the job, and bad. A week or so later, Biden received a call. The Davids wanted to see him. Axelrod and Pluff arranged to meet him in Wilmington at the home of his sister Valerie. Once again, the senator showed up in disguise. You could never be too careful, apparently, even in your hometown. The Davids had their worries about Biden, and one above the rest. Could he manage to keep his gyrating gums under control for the duration of the fall campaign? Sitting outside by the pool, Biden reassured them that he could keep his mouth in check, cited examples of how he'd done it before, promised he could do it again. In talking about how he could control his talking, Biden kept talking and talking, offering a soliloquy that, had it been a one-man play, might have been titled QED. The David silently noted the irony, then pressed Biden for a commitment. Not a vow of silence, but a pledge to stick to the script he was handed, to keep a firm grip on his tongue. Biden told them that if he got the nod, he would be a good and tight-lipped soldier. He gave them his word, as a Biden. On August 22nd, 3 days before the start of the Democratic convention, Obama phoned Kanan by, delivering his verdict with the identical phrase, "I've decided to go in a different direction." He knew Biden was the right call, the working class thing, the gray hair thing, the foreign policy thing, oh, and the attack dog thing. Obama was convinced that he could count on Biden to maul McCain. Still, right up until the moment he rendered his decision as final, Obama kept chuckling, shaking his head and thinking, "I can't believe I'm picking Biden." And neither really could McCain, who heaved a sigh of relief when he learned the news with the rest of the world the next morning. McCain and his team had feared that Obama would tap Hillary, creating a megawatt media explosion that would block out the sun, consigning McCain world to icy darkness. "Well, good for Joe," McCain told one of his advisors. "But boy, Obama will never get a word in edgewise now." As the new Democratic vice presidential pick was elevated and celebrated, the previous one sat in North Carolina, wondering how it had all gone so wrong. The past month had been sheer hell for Edwards. His life was falling apart. On July 22nd, the National Enquirer, which had become his own personal tormentor and truth squad, ran a story about him paying a secret visit to Riel Hunter and her baby. 2 weeks later, it published a grainy spy photo of Edwards holding the little girl. Edwards, panicked, assembled a handful of his former staffers, Ginsburg, Prince, Jennifer Palmieri, to strategize about how to handle the latest installment of his rolling crisis. The group was at a loss, but Edwards settled on the idea of performing a mea culpa on ABC News' Nightline. "Don't do this interview unless you plan to tell the whole truth," Palmieri told Edwards, "because if you lie, you're going to make things infinitely worse." Edwards replied that he was going to confess to the affair but deny paternity of the child. He didn't want to jeopardize his chances of being Obama's attorney general. Palmieri couldn't believe her ears. "That, John?" she said. "That was gone a long time ago." Palmieri had been on the phone with the Obama campaign, which was sending the clear, if gentle, signal that there was no longer even a slot available for Edwards to speak at the convention, that it was time for him to stand down with dignity. "You have to call Obama right now and back out," Palmieri said. "I don't want to give up on that yet," Edwards insisted. Elizabeth hadn't given up yet either. Confronted with the picture in the Enquirer of her husband cuddling the baby, she told Palmieri she still believed that John was not the father. "I have to believe it," Elizabeth said, "because if I don't, it means I'm married to a monster." As Palmieri predicted, the Nightline interview on August 8th only brought more misery for Edwards, as the world gained a vivid picture of his pathology. When reality began to sink in, he started calling his old staffers and apologizing. Edwards finally accepted that he wasn't going to be attorney general. Not only wasn't he speaking at the convention, he wasn't even welcome in Denver. Edwards felt like an outcast. His weight plummeted. Some of his former aides began to fear that he might kill himself, and though the extent of his ruin didn't reach that depth, the months ahead held something horrible enough for Edwards, a final, an all-too-public reckoning with the truth. Some days before the convention got underway in Denver, Obama found himself on a campaign swing through Boston, the city where his meteoric and historic ascent began. Riding with Gibbs, Obama noted wryly, "We were here about 4 years ago, weren't we?" "Yeah," Gibbs replied, "and our lives have been fucking complicated ever since." Obama stared out the window and said, "Very complicated." With his running mate chosen, the next challenge for Obama was to make his convention a success, and the central wrinkle was the former first couple. The Clintons of Chappaqua rarely made an inconspicuous appearance at any social occasion. They were almost always, naturally and unavoidably, the center of attention. The question was whether or how well the Clintons would behave, and judging by two recent incidents, Obama had reason to be nervous. In early August, on a trip to Africa, Bill Clinton had given an interview to Kate Snow of ABC News. After observing mulishly that everybody's got a right to run for president who qualifies under the Constitution, Clinton pointedly refused to affirm Obama's readiness to occupy the Oval Office. He also renounced his friendship with Congressman Jim Clyburn and declared with a Nixonian echo, "I'm not a racist." 2 days later, a video surfaced of Hillary at a reception in California, speaking to a crowd of female supporters about the need for catharsis in Denver, seeming to suggest that her name be placed in nomination and a roll call vote conducted. The press seized on Clinton's comments and speculated about trouble brewing. 2 months after the Obama-Clinton trip to New Hampshire, unity was still just a place on the map. Neither Hillary nor Bill had a shred of personal affection for or connection with Obama, whereas they continued to share a rapport with McCain. The Arizonan regularly phoned Bill and chatted with him about foreign policy. "Boy, McCain gets it," the Clintons would tell people. "John McCain is tough. The country might have been facing a horrible choice," as Hillary had said to Penn, but some of the Clintons' friends got the impression that the couple was more than copacetic with the Republican prevailing. Still smarting over the hits to his reputation on matters racial, and still blaming the Obamans, Bill was also now grumpy over what he perceived as being given the high hat. After the perfunctory Barack-Bill phone call in June, there had been no follow-up, no meal, no event, no requests for Clinton's counsel, and certainly no absolution. The first communication the former president's office received about the convention was a form letter that went to all of the delegates, letting Bill know he was eligible for a discounted hotel room in Denver. As was typically the case with the Clintons, Hillary was looking forward while her husband was looking back. Despite her ongoing frustration over the Obamans' failure to assist in paring down her debt, they refused even to send out email solicitations to their web donors, for crying out loud. She had started campaigning for Obama, saying all the right things on the stump, trying to inoculate herself from being blamed if he lost. For the first time, Hillary was willing to admit that Obama had what it took to win. "After what I went through with this guy," she said to a friend, "I can tell you, he's plenty tough." But Hillary also believed that Obama was capable of screwing it up, and that his minions were severely underestimating the difficulty of inducing her supporters to shift their loyalties to him. An NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that month found that only half of her voters were behind Obama, and 21% were for McCain. Hillary's talk of catharsis wasn't either idle chatter or malevolent cauldron stirring. She was simply pointing out that her people needed to have their voices heard before they would rally around the Democratic nominee. Although he had little direct contact with the Clintons, Obama had a lucid sense of where they stood. "She's okay," he told one of his advisors. "He's taking a lot longer to get over this." Obama's attitude toward the couple was sharply differentiated. From the moment he clinched the nomination, any rancor he felt toward Hillary evaporated. He needed her support, wanted her on his team, and was willing to work for it. But Bill was another story. Obama saw no benefit in kissing the ring, let alone the ass of 42. "I'd be happy to call if it would make a difference," Obama thought, "but why waste my time if the guy's just going to keep crapping all over me?" When it came to the convention, the Obamans assumed both Clintons would play nice, if only because it was in the couple's self-interest not to be perceived as the skunks at the garden soiree. The endless Clinton negotiations were annoying, to be sure. "How did you deal with these people?" Pluff asked Sallis Doyle. The unpredictability of the couple was a chafing distraction, but it was clear the Clintonites had no intention of setting off a bomb in Denver. They didn't want a floor fight. Their demands weren't crazy. They weren't even certain they wanted the roll call vote. Team Obama had hoped to confine both Clinton speeches to one evening, but word came back from Hillary land that she expected a night to herself, and the Obamans were fine with that. A certain amount of Clinton drama whipped up by an adrenalized media was inevitable, they knew. Their aim was simply to keep it from consuming the convention. The convocation opened on the hot, dry Monday afternoon of August 25th, and even before it was gaveled into session, Team Obama was receiving the first of many kicks in the teeth. On the streets of Denver, there were pro-Clinton, anti-Obama marchers. The papers were full of stories quoting Clinton delegates promising defiance. Cable news was riveted by the ravings of the Puma faction. That night on CNN, James Carville, whom the Obamans not unreasonably saw as a conduit for the Clintons, trashed the first day's proceedings. "If this party has a message, it has done a hell of a job of hiding it tonight," Carville moaned. "I look at this and I'm about to jump out of my chair." The collective reaction of the Obamans was, "What the fuck?" Hillary's speech was the following night. Bill's would be on Wednesday. If the Clintons were lackluster or subversive, the Obamans would have only one night to salvage the convention. The Clintons themselves were lying low, sulking and stewing in their suite at the Brown Palace Hotel. They thought the convention was a mess, that their supporters were being treated like second-class citizens, forced to bow and scrape for passes and other goodies. Beyond that, however, both Clintons were obsessed with their speeches. They realized the stakes involved. Hillary felt the pressure more than her husband. The eyes of the world would be on her Tuesday night as never before in the campaign. But by that morning, her speech was in good shape, she thought. She went over to the Pepsi Center, the sports arena where the first 3 days of the convention were taking place, to practice it on a prompter with the convention's dedicated speech coach, Michael Sheehan. When she was done, she returned to her room to rest. In the afternoon, she wandered down the hall to the small meeting room where her speechwriting team had been laboring over her text to rehearse it one last time. She picked up the speech, began to look it over, and was stunned to discover that the thing had been rewritten. It was unrecognizable. "This is my speech?" Clinton said. "What the hell happened to it?" "Your husband happened," her speechwriting team informed her. Bill had shown up with a pile of handwritten notes, ideas about how to restructure the speech to make it better. New lines, language, themes. The speechwriters had dutifully incorporated his edits. Hillary was furious, apoplectic. "This is my speech," she said, and then stalked out of the room and back to her suite. A few minutes later, Bill walked into the conference room looking sheepish and chastised. The speechwriters were frantically trying to reconstruct the address. There was paper strewn all over the long table, hard copies of various versions of the text. Standing over the addled aides as they cut and pasted on a laptop, Clinton attempted to pitch in. "This was here, I added this, I like that," the former president said. It was late in the afternoon by then. Hillary had only a couple of hours before she had to be on stage. Reporters were calling, asking why the Clintonites had yet to provide an advance text, accusing them of holding out. Earlier, the edgy Obamans had checked in with Sheehan about the speech and dispatched strategist Larry Grislano to the Brown Palace lobby to take the one sneak peek that the Clinton people would allow. Sheehan and Grislano reported back. "It's great," they said. They had no idea that the speech had been rewritten and now was being rewritten again in an effort to restore it. Hillary arrived at the Pepsi Center in a frenzy, still making edits in the back of the car. Then she walked on stage and knocked the ball clear into the upper deck. "Barack Obama is my candidate and he must be our president," Hillary declared. "Nothing less than the fate of our nation and the future of our children hang in the balance." The next afternoon, the roll call began. The negotiations between the two sides over this had been protracted, but not as tense as the media claimed. The Obama forces had come to realize that Clinton wasn't wrong, that the depth and passion of her support were greater than they'd imagined, that some degree of catharsis was indeed required. The Clintonites, meanwhile, had come to fear that a full roll call vote might wind up embarrassing Hillary, as large numbers of her delegates defected out of a desire to come together behind the nominee. A compromise solution was engineered, with some states casting their votes for each candidate, but then a call for acclamation by none other than Hillary herself, making a surprise appearance on the convention floor. "In the spirit of unity," she said, "with the goal of victory, let's declare together in one voice, right here, right now, that Barack Obama is our candidate and he will be our president." With Hillary having done her duty, that left Bill. There had been some tourists between the Clintonites and Obamans over his speech, but again, less than the hyperventilators in the press made out. When the Clintonites learned their boss would be appearing on a night dedicated to foreign policy, they objected, insisting that Clinton wanted to talk about the economy. Barack, who had relented and called the former president a few days before the convention, told his people he can talk about whatever he wants to talk about. And as with Hillary, there was no advance text submitted for approval, which unsettled some of the Obamans. Bill knew they were anxious, but he refused to rush. "I'm going to take my time, and when I'm done, I'm done," he told Terry McAuliffe. "If it's not done until a minute before, so be it." It was done a little earlier than that, but not much. Once again, Grisolano legged it over to the Brown Palace to take a gander. When he finished perusing the speech, Grisolano looked up at the Clintonite who delivered it and smiled. "Hey, you gotta do me one favor," Grisolano said. "What's that?" "Tell him not to change a thing." Obama shared that assessment as he watched Bill Clinton up on stage. Clinton did more than a dazzling job with his oratory. He did more than blow the room away with his charm. He said with clear premeditation precisely the words that Democrats in the hall and around the country wanted, needed to hear from him. "Everything I learned in my 8 years as president, and in the work I have done since in America and across the globe, has convinced me that Barack Obama is the man for this job. Barack Obama is ready to be president of the United States." Whether or not Clinton believed those words was, in a way, immaterial, as Obama understood. When it was over, Obama remarked to one of his aides, he went out there and did something that was really hard for him. With all the Clinton-related commotion in the first 3 days of the convention, there were few other moments that broke through. Ted Kennedy's speech on Monday night was an exception. The senator, who had been diagnosed with a lethal brain tumor 3 months before, hauled himself to Denver and delivered what would be, and what everyone in the hall knew would be, his last convention speech, on behalf of the young senator to whom his endorsement had meant so much. The other exception on the same night was Michelle Obama's speech. Ever since "Proud of My Country," Michelle's public image had been in a bad way. In the campaign's focus groups, voters volunteered their misgivings that she was unpatriotic, seemed entitled, or angry. The New Yorker had captured the caricature on its cover that summer, with a sketch portraying her as a gun-toting radical with an Angela Davis afro. The Obamans knew this was their last best chance to rescue her from becoming a toxic spouse in the vein of Teresa Hines Carey. Stealing a page from the Clinton playbook of 1992, they set out to use the convention stage to humanize her, to portray Michelle as the loving mother, sister, and daughter that she was, and one reared not in privilege, but in a blue-collar home. Working with Hillary's former speechwriter, Sarah Hurwitz, and the speech coach Sheehan, Michelle revised and rehearsed for more than a month. The payoff was worth it. Her performance, slightly nervous but winningly sincere and at times bracingly direct, "I love this country," wowed the crowd and sent her approval rating soaring, never to return to earth. Obama's speech on Thursday night was, of course, the convention's culmination and another of those big game moments that the candidate seemed to live for. Obama had amped up expectations by deciding to mimic John Kennedy's 1960 acceptance at the Los Angeles Coliseum, delivering his before nearly 100,000 people at Invesco Field, home of the Denver Broncos. That Obama would be stirring and poised was not in question. Of course he would. The question was whether he would be effective, making the case for himself and against McCain in terms more concrete and compelling than he had so far. After taking the outdoor stage amid the starbursty sparkle of thousands of camera flashes, Obama worked his way through an oration less thrilling than some of his best, but more strategic. He did biography, invoking his mother, his grandfather, and his grandmother, citing the last's rise from secretarial pool to middle management, despite years of being passed over for promotions because she was a woman, as a nod to Clinton's voters. He strafed McCain as a Bush clone who was clueless about the economy. "I don't believe Senator McCain doesn't care what's going on in the lives of Americans. I just think he doesn't know." He hinted at McCain's hot-headedness, questioning whether he had the temperament to be commander-in-chief. And he deconstructed the negative campaign that his rival had been running against him. "I've got news for you, John McCain," he intoned. "We all put our country first." Obama happened to be speaking on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream address on the Washington Mall, and he closed with a graceful reference to the young preacher from Georgia who said, "We cannot walk alone, we cannot turn back." Axelrod and Gibbs, watching from the wings, were in tears. For them, the speech was one of the rare moments in the midst of the campaign's bustle and insanity, when the magnitude of what they had accomplished sank in. As the convention closed, Axelrod was well pleased. After the lost weeks of July and August, in which McCain World had stolen a march on the Obamans, the Democrats had recaptured the flag. The chattering classes agreed with Axelrod. The convention had been a triumph. The Democrats had found their way to peace and unity. Barack and Michelle had killed, and the Clintons had piled aboard the bandwagon, at least publicly. Hillary and Bill were still bruised and still mopey, but as they flew back east from Denver, one thing had changed. They both were starting to believe that Obama was probably going to win. Obama believed it too. The next morning, he rode out to the airport and boarded his campaign jet. He was headed to Pennsylvania with Biden to begin the fall campaign in earnest. The Republican convention was scheduled to start the following Monday. McCain was due to announce his running mate any minute now. The Democratic ticket mates wondered who it would be, and then, like that, Axelrod appeared in the forward cabin and broke the news. "Wow," said Obama, picking his jaw up off the floor. "Well, I guess she's changed." But Biden looked confused. Swiveling his head, speaking for millions, he blurted out, "Who's Sarah Palin?" Chapter 20. Sarah Cuda. The plan was always for McCain to shock the world with his vice presidential pick. For weeks, his top advisors had been dreaming and scheming, touching bases and laying groundwork, secretly readying an announcement at once unconventional, unexpected, and unprecedented, which would throw the press and both parties for a loop and redraw the political map. The surprise that McCain World intended to spring was a running mate named Joe Lieberman. But then something happened on the way to the Republican convention in St. Paul, and presto changeo, there was Palin. McCain World's core conviction was that McCain's VP choice had to be a game changer. The campaign assumed the progress it had made with Celeb was a temporary blip, that Obama's financial advantages would continue to create a crushing imbalance, that the three-quarters of the electorate who were telling pollsters the country was on the wrong track and blaming the GOP would punish McCain at the polls. If McCain's running mate selection didn't fundamentally alter the dynamics of the race, it would be lights out. From 30,000 feet, the process by which McCain sought his number two looked altogether normal for many months. He'd begun back in April, with about as much time at his disposal to make his choice as any nominee in history. A tight circle of his aides, with his input, produced a long list of possibilities. A prominent Washington attorney with a reputation for probity and discretion, A.B. Culverhouse of O'Melveny and Myers was retained to head the vetting team. As the list was winnowed, Culverhouse and company conducted extensive research on the surviving finalists, preparing a lengthy and intrusive questionnaire and arranging face-to-face interviews with A.B. The customary premium was placed on keeping the pick a surprise, and a plan was developed to maximize its impact, announcing the selection soon after the Democratic convention, ideally the very next day, to stop Obama's momentum cold. Yet three of the five shortlisters produced by this seemingly rigorous process failed to meet its chief goal. Mitt Romney, Charlie Crist, and Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty all had their virtues, but game changers they were not. The fourth, New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, qualified for the label, but he also was a divorced, pro-choice, pro-gay, anti-gun, Jewish plutocrat who had switched his party affiliation from Democrat to Republican to independent as nonchalantly as if he'd been changing his loafers. Not one of them generated much enthusiasm in McCain World, or more important, in McCain, but for reasons both personal and political, the fifth man did. McCain's affection for Lieberman had only grown since the Democratic senator from Connecticut endorsed him in December. Joe became a fixture on the Straight Talk Express, traveling all over during the nomination fight, even to locales where his presence made McCain's advisors skittish. When McCain suggested that Lieberman campaign with him in South Carolina, Davis thought, "God, what are we doing? A liberal, Jewish Democrat who was Gore's running mate in South Carolina for the Republican primary?" But McCain wasn't remotely fazed. "Don't worry about it," he told Davis. "It won't be a problem." Lieberman was chummy, too, with McCain's other regular sidekick on the road, Lindsey Graham. The trio was dubbed the Three Amigos. Between Lieberman's shecky green humor and Graham's tall tales about falling asleep during meetings with foreign leaders, McCain was in stitches much of the time when his pals were around. A favorite pastime of the amigos was watching that funny YouTube video of John Edwards fixing his hair. "Let's look at it again," McCain would command, and soon they'd all be clutching their sides, emitting peals. The political case for picking Lieberman as VP was straightforward, if audacious. McCain's lieutenants maintained that it was essential that their candidate distance himself from Bush and reclaim the reformer's mantle. Nothing would do that better, went the argument, than presenting the country with a kind of national unity ticket, a pairing that literally embodied bipartisanship. Lieberman's support for the Iraq War made him reasonably popular among Republicans. His long tenure in Washington would reinforce the campaign's message of experience and drive the perception that McCain had made his choice with governing, not politics, in mind. The pick would fairly shout McCain's slogan, "Country First." Many of McCain's most influential advisors, Schmidt, Graham, the former Bush White House communications director, Nicole Wallace, were strongly in favor of the Lieberman option. The worst-case scenario, Wallace contended, was that Lieberman's pro-choice stance would cause a walkout of social conservatives from the convention, and even that would have its benefits, sending a message of independence. Astonishingly, no one among the senior staff objected to Lieberman on ideological grounds. Most of them, in fact, saw his selection as the campaign's best chance to win, assuming they could get Lieberman approved at the convention. In mid-July, Davis called Lieberman and asked if he'd be willing to be put on the short list and vetted. "Gee, this really surprises me," Lieberman said. "John doesn't have to do this to thank me for supporting him." No, he's not doing it to thank you. He's very serious about this." "Honestly, Rick, I don't intuitively see how this could happen," Lieberman said. "Well, if he's serious, it's an honor. I'm happy to go forward." For Lieberman, endorsing McCain had moved him further away than ever from the Democratic Party, and he had already taken another step in that direction by agreeing to speak at the GOP convention. His decision to be considered for the VP slot was driven in part by one thought: am I ever going to have another opportunity at this? Yet, given the political climate, Lieberman couldn't also help but wonder, am I going to have the unique honor to be the only person in history to lose twice as vice president on two different tickets? As July turned to August, Lieberman received from Graham encouraging reports about his prospects. "Schmidt gets this," Lindsay said. "He did Schwarzenegger's campaign. He knows we have to get independence." Graham added, "Cindy is for you." Lieberman still couldn't quite see how the McCain forces could get him through the convention, given his liberal views on almost every issue save national security. "If he chooses me, do you think I'd get nominated?" he asked Graham. "Of course you'd be nominated," Lindsay said. "Some minority of the convention would walk out, but I think that's not so bad for John." McCain World had a two-pronged plan for minimizing the negative convention fallout. First, the pick had to be a complete surprise, sprung at the last minute, before the opposition had time to coalesce, so Lieberman could be defined on the campaign's terms. And second, McCain would agree to take the one-term pledge he'd abandoned in the final hours before his announcement in the spring of 2007, thus eliminating the risk that he would die in office during his second term and leave a Democrat in charge. McCain once again balked at the pledge, but his advisors assured him it would be necessary if he went with Joe. Grudgingly, McCain seemed to assent, while Lieberman readily agreed. For much of August, McCain World pursued the Lieberman option with singular focus. Davis and his deputies began calling delegates, state chairmen, and other party leaders around the country, feeling out their level of resistance to a pro-choice pick, without mentioning any names. Davis crafted a convention strategy to see Lieberman through, everything from a whip operation to a sophisticated communications rollout to a lunch with conservative grandees that Charlie Black would attend the Friday beforehand to explain the rationale and rally them to the cause. No one was more gung-ho about all this than Graham. He couldn't stop talking about it with McCain, hectoring him about why Lieberman was his only hope. "But the Mormon thing, you can't pick Romney. You'll lose by 8, Graham contended. "You can't pick Pawlenty. He's a nice guy, but nobody's ever heard of him. You'll lose by 6. McCain played his cards close to his chest. "I hear you," he said. "I got you." But Graham's eager advocacy and his Biden-like loose lips wound up sinking the Lieberman option. On August 13th, while Graham was traveling with McCain on a campaign swing, he floated the idea of a pro-choice running mate to a group of social conservatives in Michigan, asking which they would prefer, a running mate who opposed abortion but caused the GOP to lose, or one who supported abortion rights and carried the party to victory. Within days, the indiscretion had leaked, flooding the mainstream press and the web with speculation about Lieberman and Republican pro-choice former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, sparking a flaming tizzy in the rightmost precincts of GOP Nation. "If the McCain camp does that," bellowed Rush Limbaugh, "they will have effectively destroyed the Republican Party and put the conservative movement in the bleachers." Anticipating this kind of reaction from the right, McCain's advisors had been quietly trying to recruit a conservative counter-chorus to sing Lieberman's praises. When they approached Karl Rove, he not only declined, but told them that picking Lieberman was a terrible idea. "If you nominate him, he'll probably get through the convention," Rove argued, "but the battle will be bloody. The vote will be close, the storyline will be bad, McCain will leave St. Paul with a split party, and no time to put it back together." That Sunday, August 24th, Rove took his concerns to Lieberman directly, pleading with the senator by phone to turn down the VP slot if McCain extended his hand. "You know him," Rove said. "He's so stubborn, he may simply get this in his mind and carry it to you, and you may be the only person who can save McCain from himself." Lieberman listened politely and said, "I hear you. I'll think about it," and then hung up, turned to his wife, and marveled at the fantastic strangeness of the situation. Lieberman had no intention of taking Rove's advice, but as it happened, McCain World was in the process of rendering the question moot. That same day, out in Arizona, McCain's senior advisors were meeting again at the Phoenix Ritz-Carlton and reluctantly coming to the conclusion that Rove was right. In a pair of meetings, one with McCain present, pollster Bill McInturff informed the group that research data he'd been studying indicated that a pro-choice pick would cost McCain votes among Republicans and gain him few, if any, among independents. "With a lot of work and elbow grease, we can get Joe through the convention," Black added, "but then we're going to have to spend September healing the party instead of concentrating on swing voters and Obama." The depth and severity of the problems raised by picking Lieberman finally hit home with McCain. "I understand," he said in a tone of resignation, and from that point on, Joe's name was never seriously raised again. That night, Schmidt and Davis drove over to McCain's Phoenix condo for dinner. The Republican convention was a week away, and they were nowhere. In the meetings earlier that day, there was no support for Romney, Crist, or Bloomberg. That left plenty. "Here's my view of the politics of it," Schmidt told McCain as they feasted on deep-fried burritos. "In any normal year, Tim Pawlenty's a great pick, a no-brainer, but this isn't a normal year. We need to have a transformative, electrifying moment in this campaign." Schmidt and Davis then placed a new option on the table, Sarah Palin. Palin's name had been on the longest of the long lists, but that was it. Davis told McCain that if he wanted to consider the governor of Alaska, he needed to phone her that night and ask her if she'd be willing to be vetted, and arrange to meet with her, pronto. McCain was impassive, but agreeable. "I'll call her," he said. "Let's call her." A few minutes later, McCain reached Palin on her cell phone at the Alaska State Fair. 15 minutes after that, McCain hung up, and Palin was on her way. She was 44 years old, had occupied the Alaska State House for 20 months, and had an 80% approval rating, making her, as Schmidt pointed out, the most popular governor in America. She'd attended 5 colleges and been a beauty queen, a sportscaster, and the 2-term mayor of Wasilla, the tiny town where she lived with her snowmobiling husband, Todd, and 5 children. She was pro-life, anti-stem cell research, pro-gun, and pro-states' rights. She had captured the governorship by running as a reformer, pledging to clean up the corrupt clubhouse politics of Juneau, and she was often at odds with Alaska's regnant Republican kingpin, Senator Ted Stevens. Her nickname from her high school basketball days was Sarah Barracuda. She was intensely competitive, apparently fearless, and endlessly watchable. McCain had met Palin in February at the annual winter meeting of the National Governors Association in Washington. She was part of a small group of Western state governors whom McCain had convened to talk about energy policy. Later that day, he and Palin spoke again for 10 minutes or so at a reception. Two nights later, they shared a table at a fundraising dinner and chatted a bit more. Afterward, McCain told Black that he liked the cut of Palin's jib. "She's damn impressive," he said. It was 6 months later when Schmidt and Davis came to the same conclusion, almost by accident. In July, Davis, who was in charge of McCain's VP process, was casting about for unconventional possibilities and sat down one day in front of his computer with a list of names of female Republican office holders. When Davis stumbled upon a video of Palin appearing on Charlie Rose, he was bowled over. So was Schmidt, who screened the clip and proclaimed, "She's a star!" As the Lieberman option became more and more imperiled at the end of August, Schmidt and Davis, afraid that this new VP idea would leak too, kept talking furtively between themselves about Palin. She seemed to be the answer to their prayers. In a way, she was the anti-Lieberman, hard right, and totally fresh. Davis considered her a triple threat, a governor, a conservative, and a would-be historic pick. Schmidt upped the ante, saying that Palin was the only candidate who might achieve all four objectives he saw as critical for McCain: excite the GOP base, rouse women voters, create space between him and Bush, and help him recapture the Maverick label. On the evening of Wednesday, August 27th, 3 days after McCain phoned Palin, she arrived at the airport in Flagstaff, Arizona, in a private Learjet from Anchorage. Palin was ferried to the home of a wealthy McCain supporter, Bob Delgado, to meet with Schmidt and Salter. It was now 36 hours from the campaign's Friday target for unveiling its Veep Stakes winner, but McCain was leaving the next morning, so the countdown clock was actually set closer to T-minus 12 hours. At that point, Culverhouse and his team had devoted just 5 days to vetting Palin, digging into public records, her hastily completed 74-part questionnaire, and her tax returns. Less investigation than a potential assistant secretary of agriculture would receive. Palin had spent just a few hours filling out the questionnaire, which had consumed weeks for other shortlisters. She had never met Schmidt. She had never met Salter. Now, in a rush against a deadline with little background information, the two McCain advisors had to determine if she was ready for the big stage. After offering Palin some pizza, Schmidt commenced his grilling. "Governor," he said, "in Alaska, you're the boss. You have a staff, advisors, and your husband, all valuable in having helped you get where you are. None of them will have a seat at the table here. Senator McCain is the boss in this effort, and your job, if you're chosen, is going to be to do what's asked of you and get comfortable real fast with the people we put around you. What's your reaction to that?" "I understand completely," Palin said. "Should this go forward," Schmidt went on, "by dinner time Friday, you'll be one of the most famous and recognizable people on the planet. Your life will never be the same. Have you thought about the impact on your family? Would you and they be 100% committed to this project going forward?" "Yes, 100%, Palin said. "Do you have confidence in your lieutenant governor and your staff to fulfill your constitutional duties as the governor of Alaska in your absence?" Schmidt asked. "Because unless there's an earthquake or a natural disaster of some magnitude, you won't likely be back home again until after Election Day. You can't be distracted by your day job. You need to be focused on this job." "Yes, absolutely. I understand," Palin said. "You and Senator McCain have differences on some issues," Schmidt continued. "He is pro-life, but he's in favor of exceptions in the cases of rape, incest, and the life of the mother being at risk. You are not. Senator McCain is in favor of stem cell research. You are not. We'll never ask you to make a statement that contradicts your beliefs, but we expect you to support his positions as the policies of the administration you'd be part of. And we may ask you to appear in ads advocating those positions. Do you have a problem with that?" "No, I don't, not at all," Palin said. Schmidt and Salter both warned Palin that her private life would be subjected to harsh, at times unfair, attacks. "Nothing you've experienced has prepared you for this, how ugly it can be," Salter said. "Nothing, nothing, nothing." "I understand," Palin said. Salter had read about Palin on his flight to Arizona and was concerned about hints that she might be a creationist. "Governor," he said flatly, "do you reject the theory of evolution?" "No," Palin said. "My father is a science teacher. He showed me fossils. I know how things evolved. I just don't think that evolution excludes a role for God." Schmidt and Salter were approaching Palin from different perspectives. Schmidt, the discipline fiend, wanted to be sure Palin was ready for what she'd face and would toe the line. Salter, the Ur-loyalist, wanted to safeguard McCain's brand, to make sure he wouldn't be teaming up with a female Pat Robertson, but neither one was poking or prodding to find every possible weakness in Palin. They asked her nothing to plumb the depths of her knowledge about foreign or domestic policy. They didn't explore her preparedness to be vice president. They assumed she knew as much as the average governor and that what she didn't know she would pick up on the fly. They weren't searching for problems. They were looking for a last-second solution. What reassured them was Palin's preternatural calm and self-possession. Never once did she betray any jitters or lack of confidence. Later that night, Palin spoke for 3 hours by phone with Culverhouse. Over the previous weekend, he had assigned a Washington lawyer named Ted Frank, who'd worked on the screening of Lieberman, to prepare a written vetting report on Palin. Thrown together from scratch in less than 40 hours, the document highlighted her vulnerabilities. Democrats upset at McCain's anti-Obama celebrity advertisements will mock Palin as an inexperienced beauty queen whose main national exposure was a photo spread in Vogue in February 2008. Even in campaigning for governor, she made a number of gaffes, and the Anchorage Daily News expressed concern that she often seemed unprepared or over her head in a campaign run by a friend. The longest section of the vetting report dealt with an ongoing ethics investigation in Alaska known as Troopergate, in which Palin stood accused of improperly pressuring and firing the state public safety commissioner after a messy dispute with members of her family. The report contained a disclaimer. Given the haste in which it was prepared, the vetters might have missed something. But Culverhouse seemed to sense that the momentum in McCain world behind picking Palin was gathering such force that the vet might be irrelevant. "We may be slowing a freight train with boxes of feathers," he said to his colleagues. The first thing Palin told Culverhouse on the phone that Wednesday night concerned a matter that she'd left off her questionnaire and neglected to tell Schmidt and Salter. Her teenage daughter, Bristol, was pregnant out of wedlock. "Is she getting married?" Culverhouse asked, then added jokingly, "Is she getting married tomorrow?" The lawyer pressed Palin about her critics in Alaska, who charged that she was too inexperienced when she ran for governor. Palin replied disarmingly, "People are still attacking me back home, but you'll notice they no longer say I'm in over my head." The next morning, Culverhouse spoke to McCain by phone. Overall, the lawyer was impressed with how Palin handled herself, but he advised McCain that compared to the alternatives, there were more potential landmines with Palin. "What's your bottom line?" McCain asked. "John, high risk, high reward," Culverhouse said. "You shouldn't have told me that. I've been a risk taker all of my life." Shortly afterward, Palin rolled up to the senator's ranch in Sedona with Schmidt and Salter. McCain and Palin walked down to a creek that ran through the property. For about an hour, they spoke privately beneath a sycamore tree. After they finished talking, McCain introduced Palin to Cindy, took a short stroll alone with his wife, and then approached his advisors for a final powwow about the pick. Salter contended that Pawlenty was young and energetic, a party modernizer but a solid conservative, and an able communicator who could connect with blue-collar voters. Palin, he said, was untested, would undermine the experience argument against Obama and might damage McCain's stature. "This is your reputation," Salter stressed. Schmidt conceded that picking Palin could go bad, but he maintained that Pawlenty would gain McCain nothing. "If I was running," Schmidt said, "I'd rather lose by 10 points trying to go for the win than lose by 1 point and look back and say, 'God damn it, I should have gone for the win.'" The most important decision of McCain's campaign was squarely in his hands, and the circumstances could hardly have been odder or more telling. Unlike Obama and his methodical process, McCain was flying by the seat of his pants. He had left himself no time and no other options. If he went with Pawlenty or any conventional pick, he believed that he would lose. Yet, in judging Palin, he was relying on a vetting so hasty and haphazard it barely merited the name. No one had interviewed her husband. No one had spoken to her political enemies. No vetters had descended upon Alaska. There had been almost no follow-up on any issues that the investigation had raised. Palin's life still was a mystery to McCain world, and she was still a stranger to McCain. But although McCain didn't know much about Palin, what he knew, he liked. She reminded him a lot of himself. The outsider's courage, the willingness to piss all over her party. He loved that she'd taken on that pork barreler Ted Stevens, whom he despised. He saw in Palin a way of seizing back and amplifying his own message of change, real change, not the bogus Obama version. "Trust your gut, John," Cindy told him, and McCain knew that she was right. McCain walked up to the deck outside his cabin where Palin was waiting and offered her the job. They shook hands, embraced, went back down to the creek to pose for some pictures, and then McCain was off. Palin collected herself and her things and left for the airport and Flagstaff with Salter and Schmidt. They boarded an afternoon charter flight to Dayton, Ohio, where she would rejoin McCain the next morning for the announcement of her selection. In the air, Palin, in a black fleece and black skirt, her hair pinned up with a clip, appeared perfectly serene, which again struck Schmidt. 5 days earlier, this woman, for all her success in Alaska, had been living in relative obscurity, without even the faintest inkling that she was being seriously considered to be McCain's running mate. And yet, here she was, totally unruffled, utterly unflustered, not even terribly excited. "You seem very calm, not nervous," Schmidt said to her quizzically. Palin nodded and replied, "It's God's plan." The Lord's stratagem certainly appeared to be working the next morning in Ohio. The campaign had pulled off a hell of a coup, secrecy-wise. When Palin took the stage with McCain, jaws dropped and eyes popped across the country and around the world. Before a throng of more than 10,000, the biggest crowd the campaign had yet seen, Palin delivered a knockout speech, filling her partner with delight, a gratifying gift on what was his birthday. After name-checking Geraldine Ferraro, the Democratic VP nominee in 1984, she gave a shout-out to Clinton and made a bid for her disaffected supporters. "Hillary left 18 million cracks in the highest, hardest glass ceiling," Palin said. "But it turns out the women of America aren't finished yet, and we can shatter that glass ceiling once and for all." In Ohio, Schmidt, drawing on his experiences managing the Alito and Roberts nominations, told Palin that the introduction of a Veep was a lot like a space launch. The period of time from the ignition of the rocket until the capsule was in orbit was 10 or 12 minutes of violent kinetic energy, Schmidt said. That's the dangerous part, but once the vehicle escaped Earth's atmosphere, it was safe. Schmidt's analogy was all too apt, and that was the problem. A successful space launch requires years of meticulous planning by scientists and engineers, stress testing the components of the rocket, running through countless simulations, discovering every potential pitfall, implementing fail-safe systems. McCain World had done precisely none of that with Palin. Her record and background, like those of any nominee, presented political challenges, but none was insurmountable with sufficient preparation. But the swiftness of the vetting, the obsession with covertness, and the suddenness of the pick meant that the campaign was ill-equipped to present and defend McCain's choice. From the moment Palin stepped on stage in Ohio, McCain headquarters was in turmoil. The phone lines were jammed with calls from reporters trying to figure out who she was. The McCain press shop was just as clueless as the journalists. There were no basic talking points in circulation or any of the materials from the Culver House vet, let alone some secret comprehensive Palin briefing book. Frantic staffers were reduced to Googling Palin's name or hitting the State of Alaska website, which was constantly crashing due to overload. Meanwhile, Palin's team was being assembled almost entirely on the fly. Her designated Sherpa, the Republican operative Tucker Eskew, was hired on the spot that Friday after he sent an unprompted email to Nicole Wallace with some ideas about how to put forward Palin. "Great, yes, have you got 63 days? Wallace wrote Eskew back. Palin's traveling chief of staff, Andrew Smith, was first approached that Sunday. A friend of Schmidt's, he had almost no political experience. Before the announcement, most of the members of Team Palin couldn't have picked their new boss out of a lineup or properly pronounced her name. They had no answers to even the most routine questions about her. By the time Palin arrived in St. Paul on Sunday night, August 31st, there were plenty of queries. What foreign countries had she visited? Had she ever been to Iraq? Had she really killed the infamous Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska, as she claimed? Did she worship at a Pentecostal church where people spoke in tongues? Had Todd been arrested for drunk driving? Had her son, Track, been busted for drugs? And most incendiary of all, was her infant son, Trig, who had Down syndrome, really her baby, or was he Bristol's? As the media typhoon whipped through St. Paul on Sunday, the McCain operation was also dealing with a genuine meteorological event. Hurricane Gustav was about to hit the Gulf Coast, raising the specter of the Republican failure to handle Katrina. Davis decided to cancel the first day of the convention, relinquishing one night of precious airtime. But there happened to be a silver lining to that cloud. For months, McCain and his aides had been dreading the prospect of Bush and Cheney on stage. Charlie Black had floated the idea of having Bush spend convention week in Africa, speaking to the delegates via satellite and restricting himself to the administration's programs to combat AIDS and malaria. At the same time, Black tried to convince Cheney to decline his convention invitation. Black thought the VP had agreed, but then signals got crossed and Cheney accepted. Now, with Monday night scotched, Cheney's appearance had been too, and Bush would be relegated to delivering a short talk by video hookup from the White House. On Monday, the embattlement of the McCain press shop reached code red. To stamp out the trig rumors whipped up by photos on the internet showing a supposedly very pregnant Palin looking remarkably svelte, Sarah and Todd acknowledged that Bristol was expecting and said she therefore couldn't be the five-month-old baby's mother. But now the National Enquirer was reporting that Palin had had an affair. Another story popped up claiming that she had once been a member of the secessionist Alaskan Independence Party, AIP. And even more threatening politically, reporters were starting to turn their attention to Palin's vetting. The press shop insisted the vet had been thorough, but journalists were skeptical, especially since McCain World was having such difficulty nailing down simple facts about Palin. Schmidt and Davis had a lot on the line here. The questions about the vet went to their performance and credibility, and to the core of McCain's sense of responsibility about governance. McCain was 72 and had a history of cancer scares. How seriously had they really examined the woman who would be in line to replace him? The next morning, Schmidt and the senior staff gathered in the communications bunker in the Minneapolis Hilton. When Schmidt asked if the campaign had figured out if Palin was ever a member of the AIP, he was told they still weren't sure. Schmidt exploded, pounding the table, hollering, ranting, and cursing. "God damn it," he shouted. "We are under attack. This is a fight for survival. We have to get our shit together." A few days earlier, the campaign had dispatched a SWAT team to Alaska to help deal with the Palin inquiries. Schmidt wanted to get them on the horn and have the history of her AIP registration checked immediately. "But it's 2 a.m. in Alaska," someone said. "The phones don't work at fucking night there," Schmidt bellowed. "Call them, and keep calling them until they pick up." Schmidt had been involved in 2 presidential campaigns, 2 Supreme Court fights, and any number of corporate crisis management brouhahas, but never had he experienced anything so intense, so savage, or so crazy. Under fire, he shifted to a tactic he had turned into an art form, blaming the liberal media. From the New York Times to the lefty blogosphere, the press was trotting out smear after smear after smear on a mission to destroy Palin, Schmidt charged. Yet the truth was that Palin's critics weren't only on the left. The reaction to her selection in much of the GOP establishment ranged from stupefaction to scorn. When Bush first caught the news of the pick on a basement television set in the West Wing, he thought at first he heard Polenti. "Interesting," he mused. But then he realized that the name was Palin and he was completely baffled. Where did that come from? The current occupant of the VP's chair had a harsher reaction. Palin was woefully unprepared, and McCain had made a reckless choice, Cheney told his friends. Similar criticisms were pouring into the ears of reporters from GOP consultants and operatives galore. The former Reagan speechwriter Peggy Noonan was caught on a live microphone on MSNBC saying of McCain's decision, "I think they went for this, excuse me, political bullshit about narratives. Every time the Republicans do that, because that's not where they live and it's not what they're good at, they blow it." Mike Murphy, one of McCain's key strategists in 2000, chimed in. "The greatness of McCain is no cynicism, and this is cynical." McCain was upset about Murphy's remark. "Why would he say that? Why would he say that?" he asked his aides lamentingly. But McCain himself did Palin no favors in an interview with ABC News's Charlie Gibson in St. Paul. "Can you look the country straight in the eye and say Sarah Palin has the qualities and has enough experience to be commander-in-chief?" Gibson asked. Oh, absolutely, McCain said, and then cited Palin's largely ceremonial role as commander of the Alaska National Guard, an argument his own campaign had rejected as ludicrous. On the eve of Palin's Wednesday night convention speech, her nomination was struggling to achieve liftoff. This is the worst mishandling of a VP choice since McGovern tapped Eagleton, a prominent GOP strategist said darkly to a reporter. I'll bet she is off the ticket inside of 10 days. Cloistered in a suite on the 23rd floor of the Hilton, Sarah Palin barely noticed the storm raging outside. Not that the atmosphere of anarchy didn't penetrate her quarters. Quite the contrary. The place was a freaking madhouse, a grand central rush hour of aides, kids, and minions. But Palin had to concentrate. There was so little time and so much to do, so much to learn, so much to change. She was having an Eliza Doolittle moment, and it was keeping her mighty busy. Take that Tuesday afternoon. Palin was sitting there in her suite, getting ready to go shoot some footage that the ad men could use in the new spots and videos they were cooking up now that she was on the ticket. Boxes of Manalo Blahniks were piled up 4 feet high and stretching 20 feet along one wall of the living room. Neiman Marcus bags were everywhere, along with several rolling garment racks loaded with suits and dresses. Maybe 60 outfits, beautiful threads, purchased by a New York personal shopper whom Nicole Wallace had found for her. A fleet of Hollywoodish stylists in tight black jeans and high heels were hovering and strutting. In the corner, an elderly African-American seamstress was hunched over a sewing machine. Palin was in her robe, seated at a desk. Wallace was there coaching her on the pronunciation of the proper names in the text of her address, repeating them over and over like a speech therapist. Every so often they would pause so that Palin could model a new outfit. If they liked it, fine. If not, they would often suggest an alteration. Lose the lapel. It would be better sleeveless. And the seamstress would go to work. When Fred Davis, McCain's media guy, walked into the suite, a couple of the stylists were applying some kind of hot iron contraption to Palin's hair. There was steam coming off the top of her head that looked to Davis like smoke. For a moment, he thought, oh my God, her hair's on fire. Palin greeted Davis, whom she knew slightly from some work he had done on her gubernatorial race. She wanted his opinion on a matter of no small importance. My brand is hair up, isn't it? She asked. Yes, it is, Davis said. In the first 48 hours in St. Paul, Palin's existence was a political version of Extreme Makeover, and the clothes were only a part of it. To Schmidt's way of thinking, Palin faced three big hurdles. The first was her convention speech on Wednesday night. The second was her inaugural national interview, which would take place 10 days hence with Charlie Gibson. And the third was Palin's debate in early October with Joe Biden. In Schmidt's view, they had no time to waste. For Gibson and other future interviews, and especially for Biden,